he's given us the intriguing subtitle, which perhaps hints that some of his characteristic, intelligent and critical irony will be present in his lecture, The Adventures of a Good Citizen. In view of his eminence on his chosen topic, it's hardly surprising that as well as members of the British Australian Studies Association, members of University College London, and of the wider public, there are also numbers of people from the Australian media here. However, this is not, as I say, not a surprising thing, and it's perhaps slightly ironic also that this is despite a rival attraction today in Paris in the person of Senator Gareth Evans, who has either arrived or is about to arrive, I'm not sure which. Now, when talking about a career such as John Pilger's, there's a whole string of stale cliches which are often applied, and I don't propose to use any of them. Well, cliches like crusading journalists, so I've left one string out, which seemed to me to be off the shelf and not to fit the case. That is to say, there is something altogether more interesting and complex in John Pilger's career. He has, of course, been recognised by a string of major awards for his media and journalistic work, awards granted from a number of different countries, in the United Kingdom, in Australia, and the United States, certainly. And he has also, in comparatively recent years, been given honorary degrees by both British and an Irish university. John Pilger is a great journalist, certainly, but he's also many other things. He's a playwright, a filmmaker, and on the grand scale, no less than 43 films. He's the author of a string of acclaimed books. My personal favorite is Australia, a Secret Country, both for its incisive tackling of what one might call dark silences in Australia's past and present, but also because it seems to me to have strong elements of it, of a genre of which many Australians excel, autobiography. And rereading it recently, I was almost persuaded that I like Bondi Beach. almost persuaded. Which was actually going quite far, because I've never, I don't dislike it, but it's never sort of given me an enormous buzz. However, on a more serious level, of course, one would associate John Pilger's work across all these various genre and media that he's worked in as at least I would see it as a steady gaze of an intelligent critical conscience. To some, he is no doubt a stirrer. But since his stirring has been crucially, it seems to me, to arouse the human conscience about dark silences, about things which are hidden, about things which are laundered out of both memory and present consciousness, then it seems to me this is a stirring that we certainly need in modern times. So it's a stirring which seems to me of the most socially valuable sort, of the most intellectually valuable sort, and at the absolute pole from the vulgar, phony controversialist who'll do anything, roll in a pigsty or whatever, as long as people will pay attention. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to introduce John Pilger.
Thank you, Ian, and I'm sorry you have ambivalent feelings about Bondi Beach.
I like Bondi.
We could be here a long time on just that subject alone. And I'm grateful to you and to the British Australian Studies Association for inviting me to give this biannual lecture this evening. I'm a fifth generation Australian. My great-great-grandfather arrived in 1821 in Leg Irons, having been convicted in his native island of uttering unlawful oaths. And for this he was sentenced to 14 years transportation to New South Wales, more than the Tolpoddle martyrs got for forming a trade union. So whatever he did, it must have been quite magnificent. And this evening I would like to uphold what should be an Australian tradition and utter a few unlawful oaths about the way Australia's place in the world, and especially its own world of Asia and the Pacific, has been distorted by those of our representatives who serve external power while claiming they have a completely new independent foreign policy that not only serves the national interest but makes Australia, in the words of Foreign Minister Gareth Evans, an international good citizen. And by external power I mean a modern form of imperial power, the kind of power that only occasionally needs Australian gunboats. The last time was the call to the Gulf in 1991. The kind of power that operates through the control of resources, cartels, and capital. Now, service to great power is, of course, a great Australian tradition. Such was our colonial upbringing, and such was our fear of Asia, where it was presumed that the yellow hordes were about to fall down on us as if by the force of gravity, that an Australian statesman was someone distinguished not for any commitment to national independence, but to the powerful external interests he served almost by instinct. Interests that offered at least the illusion of protection against the yellow hordes. Thus Robert Menzies was an Australian statesman. And yet the same man could write in his diaries, "A sick feeling of repugnance grows in me every time I near Australia." Our modern statesmen are not so afflicted. Indeed, seldom a day goes by when they are not declaring a love of country. Yet fundamentally, the job description has changed only in form. The old fear of Asia is said to have gone completely, but has it? Or has it been merely sublimated and redefined by strategic planners? For this fear still lies at the heart, not of public concern, but of establishment thinking, producing a different form of obsequiousness to external power that betrays Australia's deep colonial roots and any notion of true independence. The language has certainly changed. In the days of the old colonial power, the euphemisms for greed and exploitation usually had something to do with God, supporting the slaughter and repression of peoples in the Americas, Africa, Asia, and Australia was basically God's work. These days, while some might go along with that rationale, it wouldn't sound quite right on the evening news. For example, the Foreign Minister, Senator Evans, announced today that in selling arms to the Indonesian regime, his government was doing God's work. Now, the preferred euphemism is serving the national interest in an interdependent world. So, Senator Evans said today that in selling arms to the Indonesian regime, his government was serving the national interest. It's much better. I think it's very important to understand this Orwellian application of language if we are to translate the statements and actions of those who, like Foreign Minister Evans, claim to be serving the national interest. Consider the other Orwellian terms that form the public language of modern colonial power. Terms such as economic growth, promoting human rights, quiet diplomacy, regional security, free trade, comprehensive settlement, and of course, peacekeeping. The American-led attack on Iraq was described by President Bush as essentially a peacekeeping operation. The fact that some 200,000 people were slaughtered in the process was, of course, irrelevant. Like peacekeeping in the Gulf, if you take each of these modern jargon terms of power and examine the record of their application, you will find that they mean pretty much the opposite of what the dictionary says they mean. Just as Orwell in 1984 wrote that peace meant war, two of my favourites are the words moderate and stability. For example, no journalist, no academic, no writer can simply express the truth about one of the pivotal disasters of the 20th century, the Vietnam War. They can't say that the United States, with Australia in its pocket, was not dragged into Vietnam or got there because of some colossal but otherwise honourable mistake, as Robert McNamara recently claimed, but that it consciously, deliberately, and as a matter of long-standing policy attacked Vietnam, including South Vietnam, which it was meant to be saving. Even suggesting this now, 20 years after the end of the war, is not at all being moderate. It's regarded as an extreme position. In the pages that Australian newspapers recently devoted to the anniversary of the end of the war, I couldn't find a single statement by a politician or a public official that told this unvarnished truth. Of course, moderate and stability were popular long before Vietnam. In the 1930s, the American government described Hitler as a moderate and a beacon of stability, standing between the extremes of left and right in Germany. Mussolini was another moderate. In the 1980s, Saddam Hussein was a moderate, contributing stability to the region. In 1966, the year after General Suharto came to power in Indonesia, the doyen of Australia-Indonesia specialist, Professor J.A.C. Mackey, eulogized about the new regime's anti-communism and especially its moderate character. The new moderate government in Jakarta, he said, was clearly committed to stability and, I quote, to good neighbourly relations with nearby countries. The Australian government was urged to support the new regime in the national interest. The fact that Suharto and his generals had just slaughtered between 300,000 and 1 million of their countrymen in seizing power was not mentioned by Professor Mackey. Neither was the fact that Australia's ally, the United States, had backed and taken part in the bloodbath, as declassified documents now make clear. A bloodbath now regarded as one of the most barbarous acts of the 20th century. Clearly, these facts were not relevant to the exciting, comforting news of Indonesia's newfound stability. That is, Suharto's violent repression of every basic freedom and human right, and to the value of this stability to Australia's national interest. Suharto's commitment to neighbourly relations, which Professor Mackey extolled, was subsequently expressed in the Indonesian invasion of neighbouring East Timor in 1975, the annexation of that country in defiance of the United Nations, and the extermination of at least 200,000 East Timorese, or a third of the population. And when I say at least 200,000, I'm quoting the 1993 report of the Australian Parliament's Joint Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade. This figure was the result of a study by two leading scholars in their field, Terence Hull, the ANU demographer, and Patricia Thatcher of Monash University's Anthropology Department. There are many equally credible sources for the horrific facts of the crime in East Timor, a crime greater proportionately than the universally recognised genocide committed by Pol Pot in Cambodia. Yet in the very week that this Australian parliamentary report was being written, a prominent member of Parliament, Prime Minister Paul Keating, was in the United States demanding, in effect, that President Clinton soft pedal on Indonesia's human rights record. Keating demanded that Clinton ignore a recent congressional ban on arms sales to Indonesia because of the atrocities, because of the atrocities in East Timor. On hearing of this spirited support by the Australian Prime Minister, Indonesia's ambassador in Canberra declared, "Keating is our comrade in arms," and indeed he is. For the accuracy of that statement is now beyond dispute. Since the Suharto regime massacred some 270 young people in a cemetery in Dili in November 1991, the Australian government has become part of the Indonesian war effort in East Timor. During last March, Indonesian naval vessels secretly took part in military exercises in northern Australian waters, while Indonesian special forces trained with the Australian Army. These included the same Capacis units that were largely responsible for killing 60,000 people in the first few months of the Indonesian invasion of East Timor, and which have maintained the reign of terror throughout the occupation. And these are the same units that run death squads in northern Sumatra and Aceh. I sometimes wonder, doesn't the proud history of the Australian digger mean anything to those senior Australian officers who enthusiastically collaborate with these murderers? Also in March, the Defence Department invited to Australia the former military commander of Eastern Indonesia, Major General Panjantan. Although not stated, his mission clearly was to shop for weapons. That's his civilian job now. But in 1991, he was the senior officer in command of Indonesian forces in East Timor at the time of the Dili massacre. This is the same man who was later sued in the United States by Helen Todd, whose son Kamal, a student at the University of New South Wales, was one of the massacre victims. Mrs. Todd was awarded $14 million in a New Jersey court in damages, in a Boston court, in damages against the general whom the judge identified as the man responsible for her son's death and for the massacre. Last year, a United Nations special rapporteur described the Dili massacre as, and I quote, a planned military operation against unarmed civilians. And yet this allegedly retired general, a major war criminal by any standard, was feted in Canberra and defended by Foreign Minister Evans, who said, and I quote, he received his punishment by having to leave the military. This brings me to an important statement of principle by Senator Evans, speaking on behalf of the Australian government and the Australian people. In describing Australia as a good international citizen, Senator Evans said, and I quote, a commitment to good international citizenship demands no less than acting to help secure universal international adherence to universal rights. These rights include, he said, the right to liberty and security of person, the right to a fair trial, to freedom from torture and cruel punishment. None of these rights exist in Suharto's Indonesia, and especially in East Timor. In its report last year, Power and Impunity, Amnesty International, for the first time in its history, effectively declared a leading government criminal. That government is the military dictatorship in Jakarta. In documenting systematic barbarities perpetrated or condoned by the regime, Amnesty described atrocities, and I quote, on a staggering scale. Hundreds of thousands of civilians, says the Amnesty report, have been killed, their mutilated corpses sometimes left in public places to rot. Prisoners have been routinely tortured, some so severely that they have died or suffered permanent injury. Thousands of people have been in prison following show trials solely for their peaceful, political or religious views. Scores have been shot by firing squads, some after more than two decades on death row, unquote. It's a measure of the strength of purpose behind the Amnesty report that it makes special mention of the complicity and silence of the so-called international community, and especially those Western governments that have armed, trained and given legitimacy to a military establishment structured not to defend the country, but to control the Indonesian people. The governments of America, Europe and Japan are guilty of this complicity and silence, but only one government, that of Australia, has tied the credibility of virtually its entire foreign policy to this complicity, and only one foreign minister, Gareth Evans, has defended incessantly the fascists in Jakarta, and fascists they are by any understanding whatsoever. Gareth Evans, the man who spoke of securing universal adherence to universal rights, who said that every human being had the right to a life free from fear and torture and cruel injustice. Evans, the constitutional lawyer who once proposed a Bill of Rights for Australia, has become the world's leading apologist for a regime described by Amnesty as casual about mass murder. In his book Cooperating for Peace, which is meant to be a review of the world's trouble spots, Evans does not once mention the genocide in East Timor. In a book of such pretensions, this is the moral equivalent of denying the Jewish Holocaust. Like Jakarta's roving Lord Hor-Hor, he time and again insists that human rights are improving in East Timor, as he did shortly before the Dili massacre, which he called an aberration. And when Jakarta set up a fake inquiry that made scapegoats of a few soldiers, sending one on a holiday to Bali, he congratulated the regime, calling their actions helpful and encouraging, even though six of the Santa Cruz demonstrators were given prison sentences up to life. Last year, when I and my colleagues went undercover in East Timor, we found witnesses to a second massacre in November 1991. A massacre of scores of wounded who had been taken to a military hospital in the morgue, where they were beaten to death with rocks and given lethal injections by Indonesian doctors. The East Timorese community in Australia has been trying to tell the Australian government about this second massacre for almost 2 years, but were ignored. Now, with the evidence clear in my film, Death of a Nation, Gareth Evans' response was not to examine the evidence, not even to watch the film, but to abuse me personally. Later, when the abuse clearly wasn't working, Evans announced, and I quote, that all the available evidence, unquote, showed there was no substance to the allegations of a second massacre. What evidence? He couldn't say. As my film was shown around the world, the Indonesian regime's desperate propaganda to counter it relied almost entirely on baseless denials and smears supplied by my country's foreign minister, who by any interpretation now acted as an agent of a foreign dictatorship. Since the United Nations Special Investigator last year found that the Dili massacre was, and I quote, a planned military operation, that the so-called inquiry that followed it was fraudulent, and that the killers, and I quote, enjoy virtual impunity, Evans has remained silent. Since Amnesty International, East Timor's Bishop Carlos Felipe Bello, and numerous other eyewitnesses have since confirmed that a second massacre took place, Evans has remained silent. I should say that as one who has always gone to the front line to learn and report, I find it difficult to disguise my contempt for those who at great distance make ill-informed and cynical decisions that give comfort to regimes of murderers and torturers, and then when they are caught out, attempt to stall the truth by slandering its messenger. I've known journalists in the Third World who have been imprisoned, tortured, and even murdered as a result of the kind of casual slander that at times seems standard practice among certain senior Australian politicians. For example, last month, an Australian nurse, Simon Defoe, returned from East Timor, where he had worked for the Catholic Church for 2 months. During that time, he witnessed the horrors of the military occupation from the clinics and hospitals where he had treated the victims of Indonesian atrocities. These included women who'd been raped and men tortured by being tied naked to a metal bed with electric wires attached to their penises. Mr. Defoe discovered that the so-called civil development that Indonesia boasts as having given to East Timor, such as clinics and basic medical equipment, boasts that Australian officials echo constantly, was a sham for the majority of the people, as indeed I found. On March the 8th, Mr. Defoe met the Australian ambassador to Indonesia, Alan Taylor, who was on one of his guided tours of East Timor. Mr. Defoe was told by an Australian official not to speak to the media about what he had experienced. They weren't interested, he said, in what I had seen and told me to keep quiet about it. Since then, Mr. Defoe has not kept quiet about it and has been subjected to a whispering campaign that somehow his reporting lacks credibility. This, of course, is nothing new. In 1975, the then Australian ambassador to Indonesia, Richard Walcott, secretly warned Canberra that an invasion of East Timor was coming. And I quote, "We should act," he cabled, "in a way designed to minimise the public impact in Australia and show private understanding to the Indonesians of their problem," unquote. Walcott went on to run the very centre of international good citizenship, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. His devotion to the genocidal regime in Jakarta has helped to shape Evans's foreign policy. He is currently on a short list of 10 for the next Governor General. I've never been anywhere like East Timor. At times it seemed as if I had stumbled on some great and unrecorded disaster. I can only compare it to arriving in Cambodia soon after the overthrow of Pol Pot. I found a land of crosses, great black crosses etched against the sky, crosses on peaks, crosses on the hillsides, crosses on the roadside. In East Timor, these crosses make up 1,000 calvaries. They are the markers of genocide. They litter the earth and they crowd the eye. The inscriptions on them, on some of them, are normal, those of generations departed in proper time and sequence. But look at the dates of these and you will see that they are all prior to 1975, when proper time and sequence ended. Look at the dates on most of them and they reveal the extinction of whole families, wiped out in the space of a week, a day, from old people to newborn babies. Senator Evans's response to this carnage has been to fly not far from the hillsides of Crosses over the Timor Sea in a Royal Australian Air Force jet, toasting his Indonesian opposite number Ali Alatas in Champagne as the pair of them celebrated the signing of the Timor Gap Treaty. This treaty divides the spoils of East Timor's suffering, principally its oil and gas reserves. According to Evans, the oil could be worth, and I quote, "zillions of dollars to Australian companies." Never was modern imperialism flaunted as brazenly and insultingly to its victims and to the memory of some 40,000 East Timorese who died fighting alongside and protecting Australian commandos in heroic actions that may well have stopped the Japanese from invading Australia. Only Australia has this debt of blood and honour to the East Timorese. I found the name of one of these Timorese who helped to save Australia on a list of those massacred by the Indonesian army in 1983. His name was Celestino dos Anjos. He'd been trained in Darwin and wore an Australian uniform when he and his Australian comrades were dropped behind Japanese lines early in the war in East Timor. 40 years later, he and his pregnant daughter-in-law were made to dig their own graves before they were shot in the back by Indonesian soldiers. When asked about his government's de jure recognition of Indonesia's brutal occupation of the country whose people had helped to save Australia, Evans said, and I quote, "There is no binding legal obligation not to recognise the acquisition of territory by force," he added. "The simple truth is that the world is a pretty unfair place." Not a single Timorese veteran has been properly honoured by the Australian government for the bravery of his people during World War II. Yet a few weeks ago, Gareth Evans' champagne-drinking buddy and partner in piracy, Ali Alatas, the official apologist of a genocidal regime, was awarded the Companion of the Order of Australia, Australia's highest honour. He was given this award, according to the government, and I quote, "for his development of our dialogue on human rights." This year, the International Court of Justice has considered the legality of the Timor Gap Treaty in an action brought by Portugal. In February, Evans told the Australian Cabinet that he had given the Jakarta regime unprecedented detail of the case that Australia would argue before the court. He had done this, he said, to minimise Indonesian sensitivity over the case. In fact, the international good citizen has been on trial in The Hague without a case to argue beyond legal technicalities. Next week, the court is likely to hand down its judgment. According to Professor Roger Clark, the world authority on the law of the sea, the treaty has a very simple analogy in law. It is acquiring stuff from a thief, he said. If you acquire property from someone who stole it, you are a receiver. The fact is that neither Indonesia nor Australia has the slightest historical, legal, or moral claim to East Timor and its resources. The Australian government is complicit, like a receiver of stolen goods, unquote. The sad irony of this for us Australians, and for the honour of our history, is that not only is Evans wrong in claiming that there is no legal obligation on states not to recognise territory acquired by force, but that a legal obligation was hammered out by Australian officials at the United Nations in 1970 and co-sponsored by Australia in a landmark resolution before the General Assembly. On the 25th anniversary of the United Nations, this was Australia's gift of true international good citizenship to the world. Just as 25 years earlier, the first President of the General Assembly, the Australian Foreign Minister Herbert Vere Evatt, helped to frame the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. From that high point, those of us with a sense of the good and noble things in our recent past will observe how low the name of our country has been dragged. Why? The answer is the same kind of greed and theft that the 19th century imperialists made into a crusade. These days, the crusade is called globalization, which means the imposition of Western and Japanese power, not with gunboats, but with free trade, a wonderful euphemism for a series of interlocking deals between the governments and corporations of the rich world and the elites and dictators of the poor world. Deals like GATT and NAFTA that are designed to benefit the powerful few and to exploit the majority. Last year, Prime Minister Paul Keating made an extraordinary speech in which he announced one of these deals, a partnership, he called it, with Indonesia. The partnership, he said, and I quote, would stand as a model for cooperation between developed and developing countries, unquote. Translate that and you have a model for complicity in the attack on a defenseless neighbor, a model for standing back while your neighbor's people are slaughtered, a model for stealing their resources. These models, said Keating, have been, quote, the single most beneficial strategic development to have affected Australia and its region in the past 30 years, unquote. He was surely being ironic, but no. Without a single reference to East Timor or to the carnage wrought on a staggering scale by the Suharto regime in its own country, to quote Amnesty, the Keating speech was itself a model for the suppression of historical truth in pursuit of the dollar, regardless of the human cost. All reference to the hundreds of thousands of deaths that have paid for this great benefit to Australian commercial life was also excluded from the press reporting of Keating's speech. In the same way that Stalin's crimes were eradicated from the press of communist Eastern Europe. Australia's only national newspaper, Rupert Murdoch's Australian, was ecstatic. The Jakarta regime, it said in an editorial, can now be declared moderate. Keating is, of course, the master of globalisation within Australia. As Treasurer and Prime Minister, he has taken a society that once could boast the most equitable spread of personal income in the world and divided it into chasms of rich and poor, as Thatcher did here. His outstanding achievement is one of the highest rates of poverty and unemployment in the Western world. A law he personally pushed through in 1988 turned the Australian media into the most narrowly based in any democracy, with the plums owned by a few very rich corporate mates. Rupert Murdoch, for example, now controls 70% of the metropolitan press, and he won't stop there. So it's not difficult to understand Keating's enthusiasm for the Jakarta regime, which has turned into Indonesia into a model of third world globalization and stability, meaning one of the world's greatest sweatshops, where workers and their families try to survive on less than a dollar a day, where Suharto's mates are all multimillionaires and the press is tightly controlled, along with the trade unions. So the partnership makes sort of sense, as both societies are shaped to fit the new world order. Occasionally, those objecting to this order can cause embarrassment, such as last year when protesting Indonesian journalists were beaten by police outside Keating's hotel in Jakarta. As if to demonstrate his take-it-or-leave-it attitude to Australia's fawning Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, Suharto had chosen to close down the country's only vaguely liberal newspapers and magazines on the very day that his Australian partners landed in Jakarta. For his part, Keating has referred to Suharto as a father figure and a great statesman who has brought development to his country. Development is, of course, another Orwellian term. Chamberlain's Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, said something similar in praise of Hitler in the 1930s. I have to say, it's a puzzling feature of Australian diplomacy that those who talk tough in public very often disport themselves in private. Like Evans, Keating is proud of his pugnacious style. He's called his opponents in Parliament harlots, sleazebags, boxheads, pieces of criminal garbage and pissants. After one visit to the great statesman in Jakarta, Keating ordered a video to be made of his more theatrical performances in Parliament and had it sent to the great statesman. According to the Sydney Morning Herald, the great statesman was so impressed that he showed it to his cronies and they all laughed. Scott Burchell has described this Australian servility to great power as a pathology of dependency. In Centennial Park, Sydney, near where I grew up, there used to be a small stone monument overgrown with grass that no one noticed. It marked the spot where the Australian states were ceremonially brought together as a federation. It was here that the nation was born. Yet no one seemed to give a damn then. Why? I'm not really sure, but perhaps the truth that monument represented was somewhat shaming. The last thing that most Australians wanted then was independence. What they wanted were assurances of imperial fidelity, a pat on the head from a great protector. And I believe this insecurity still influences our relationship with power, be it American, European, or Asian. As Senator Evans remarked recently with pride, Australia is the only country to have fought alongside the United States in all its foreign wars. Indeed, it's a painful irony that Australians have shed more battlefield blood than most, and that so much of this sacrifice has not been in the cause of independence, but in the service of an imperial master. We fought in China so that the British could continue trading in opium. We fought in New Zealand so that the British could subdue the Maori people. We fought in South Africa so that the same English ruling class could crush the Boers and control the Cape. We rushed to take part in the slaughter generated by the squabble between Kaiser Bill and his English cousin. We fought in Korea and Vietnam with the Americans. A friend of mine, an Australian Vietnam veteran, was once told by an American officer, "You see, the British have the Gurkhas, and we have the Australians." And when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, we were off to the Gulf before anyone asked us. "Big countries," said Bob Hawke, "cannot invade small countries and get away with it." The people of East Timor would agree with that. But they had nothing to offer but their lives and their history of loyalty to us. Curiously, it's the Labour government of Hawke and Keating and Evans that has claimed to be the first truly modern independent Australian government, promoting, to quote Evans, a new internationalism, as well as the already mentioned international good citizenship. The clear implication was that Australia had at last broken free of the demands of great power. The record tells a very different story. On coming to power, the Hawke government remained silent on the American invasion of Grenada. It supported the American invasion of Panama. It remained silent on the American terror campaigns against Nicaragua and said nothing about the American-run terror in El Salvador and Guatemala. It sent ships to the Gulf because, as I've mentioned, Hawke said that big countries couldn't attack small countries and be allowed to get away with it. It refused to back the Palestinians in any way. It opposed democratic reform in Hong Kong and had kept aid going to Thailand while the Thai military slaughtered hundreds on the streets of Bangkok. On one of Bob Hawke's many trips to Washington to see those he called his old mates, he was assured that the American spy base at Narunga in South Australia was not being used for Star Wars research. We now know this to be false, that the spying of both Narunga and Pine Gap effectively placed Australians on the front line of a potential nuclear war in Europe, and this is still the case. In 1983, two phone calls from American Secretary of State George Shultz to Hawke scuppered a Labour Party commitment to send aid to Vietnam. On orders from the Americans, the Hawke government did everything it could to sabotage New Zealand's brave decision to bar nuclear ships from its waters. At the same time, Treasurer Keating, as he then was constantly in New York seeking the approval of Wall Street for his economic policies. The centerpiece of Australia's independent foreign policy and good citizenship has been the Evans Peace Plan for Cambodia. I've often been puzzled by this, for there was hardly an Evans plan at all, simply a great power plan set in motion by Washington with China's approval. Throughout the 1980s, Washington's aim was to appease China, Pol Pot's principal backer, as part of its Cold War against the Soviet Union, and to rehabilitate and use the Khmer Rouge to bring down the Hun Sen government and to punish Vietnam. In the summer of 1989, as the Vietnamese were leaving Cambodia on their own accord, the Americans and Chinese devised what they call a tripartite government. I'm sorry, quadripartite government for Cambodia. The plan was to install four factions in power in Phnom Penh, including the Khmer Rouge, who had put to death about 1.5 million Cambodians. Gareth Evans became an enthusiast for this plan, especially for the inclusion of the Khmer Rouge, who at that time had been beaten back into Thailand by the Vietnamese and Hun Sen's army. Evans demanded what he called even-handed treatment for them. And at the Paris Peace Conference in August 1989, he proposed in private that the word genocide be dropped from Australian briefing documents. Evans's support for rehabilitating the Khmer Rouge as an instrument of Western power was inspired by Congressman Stephen Sollars, then chairman of the powerful House Committee on Asia and the Pacific. Sollars was a Cold Warrior who wanted to stamp out all vestige of Vietnamese influence in Indochina. He had backed a Khmer Rouge-dominated coalition army based in Thailand, and he now effectively ran America's Cambodia policy. When he and Evans met in Washington that autumn, he signed up Evans to run the new American crusade. Evans seized the opportunity, but there was never any doubt who was pulling the strings. Indeed, when Evans made a proposal of his own, a good one, that Cambodia's seat at the United Nations should not be occupied by Pol Pot's man, but left vacant, he was slapped down by Washington. At that time, Labour Party branches were in open rebellion at Evans's support for bringing back the Khmer Rouge. And the day after my film on Cambodia, warning of the dangers of a revitalized Khmer Rouge, was shown in Australia, Evans announced the so-called peace plan, which had been given to him by Sollars. No one can begrudge any important functionary role if the plan in any way offers peace to the people of Cambodia. But this one didn't. It had two aims: to get the Hun Sen regime out of power and to give the post-Cold War United Nations, now effectively run by America, a model role that could be applied wherever great power needed it. I've not the time here to go over every detail of the plan and its implementation. Suffice to say that a so-called comprehensive settlement included the Khmer Rouge, who were welcomed back to Phnom Penh while UN officials contorted themselves, morally and intellectually, to accommodate those who had killed a fifth of the population. The UN conducted elections which the Khmer Rouge ignored, It brought back refugees, then it got out, leaving the Khmer Rouge with four times the territory it had previously won on the battlefield. In other words, in half of Cambodia, Pol Pot now had a military advantage he did not have before the UN arrived. And that is pretty much the situation now, in spite of a great deal of self-serving nonsense from Canberra, that the Khmer Rouge are beaten. They are not. How could they be? I was in Cambodia recently, and it's clear they have an open border into Thailand, where they have just built a huge new base camp on the border. They have all the weapons they need. They are the richest terrorist organization in history, with an income of millions of dollars from logging and gemstones. And last year, they routed the government army. And yet, for claiming the credit of this disaster, Evans was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize by none other than Congressman Sollars. Moreover, the self-congratulation has hardly stopped in Australia, preventing the sort of informed critical analysis that is so urgent as Cambodia once again struggles. While ignoring the fact that as recently as a year ago, Evans was, incredibly, still calling for an unelected role for the Khmer Rouge in the Cambodian government. Australians who care deeply about Cambodia deserve better than this. It is this lack of independent appraisal of foreign policy and the capacity and will to see through smokescreens that ought to be of grave concern in Australia. The media and the cosy relationships that bloom in Canberra are only part of the problem. Beneath the surface, there is an even more serious structural fault. I'm referring to Australia's academic elite, especially those in strategic studies and international relations. Who of these experts speak out, daring to say that the Emperor hasn't even got his socks on? The former distinguished professor of international relations at ANU, J.D.B. Miller, admitted after his retirement that if there had been any criticism of the Vietnam War from his specialist academics, then his department would have, as he put it, been snuffed out. As Michael McKinley has pointed out, 20 years after the end of the Vietnam War and 5 years after the end of the Cold War, Miller's inhibitions live and breathe as the priority of academic survival. With government bureaucracy and the leading academic institutions joined by a revolving door, we have created an academic culture inclined to value the government connection more highly than intellectual independence and courage. The dangers are obvious. Although devoted to what they call realism, these establishment strategic experts fail to predict the end of the Cold War. Out of collective or individual cowardice, they have not dared to speak out publicly on the crime of East Timor, or at least to point out, in terms of realpolitik, the danger of identifying too closely with one regime and one clique. The Suharto clique will not last forever, and when it goes, there will be many Indonesians who will hate Australia for its part in their oppression. And where are those academic voices who are prepared to break with the orthodoxy of globalization that is causing the greatest economic divisions between human beings the world has known? And where are those experts who challenge the government as it builds a national security state based on secrecy and the criminalizing of those who blow the whistle on official wrongdoing? I hope we shall hear from them before the Australian Secret Intelligence Service resumes its antics on behalf of British and American interests. An honourable dissenter at ANU, Michael McKinley, has had the courage to point out that Gareth Evans's textbook, Cooperating with Peace, ought to be called Organising for War, for its jargon pays homage to an American-dominated UN in which so-called preventative diplomacy means doing what you like
where you like, as long as you're strong enough. The announcement by the French that they intend to resume nuclear testing in the South Pacific has highlighted just how frightened our leaders apparently are. This was Senator Evans' response to the French last week. "It remains to be proven," he said, "that there is a serious and widespread impact from the tests." The Australian public, who are so often dismissed privately by our elite as apathetic, even stupid, have reacted with derision to the Australian government's compliance, and Evans's outrageous statement has been treated with appropriate disregard by people who understand that his refusal to stand up to the French is both a betrayal of them and the national interest. The Treaty of Rarotonga, signed by the small island nations of the South Pacific, is a bold and imaginative attempt to abolish nuclear weapons from the vast area of the southern world, much of it defiled by French and American testing. To most of the signatories, the treaty is an article of faith in their own independence. Although Australia has signed the treaty, Australian diplomats worked hard to minimize its provisions so that American nuclear-powered and armed ships could be allowed into the zone by speaking out against the French, Australia at least might salvage some moral authority in its own region. I reported the earlier French tests from the islands close to Mururoa Atoll. There were studies I and other journalists acquired, which were conducted secretly by French scientists in Tahiti, that showed conclusively that the tests overground and underground seriously affected the food chain and caused widespread contamination. Australian scientists have long known about the thyroid cancer caused in Australia. So Evans is deceiving the public when he couches his shameful reply to the French in terms that doubt the consequences of their actions. But this is, of course, in line with his response to other human rights outrages. The so-called independent foreign policy pursued by Senator Evans is a charade. The Foreign Minister is an old-fashioned apologist for great power, and his fine description of Australia as a good citizen acting to help secure universal adherence to universal human rights is hot air. The obsession with great economics, with making a dollar a handful of corporations, not the Australian people, has led this government to regard notions of people as GNP statistics. Thus, the dictatorship in Jakarta is to be supported while these Timorese, who helped us in our darkest hour, are to be abandoned to their fate. And the French are to be appeased while the protests of the ordinary people of Australia and the South Pacific are to be treated with contempt. Replacing the Queen with a President is long overdue, and all they were all. But true independence requires much more than a fine gear. I think Australia can prove its independence in Asia in its own world. No doubt about that. That's where Australia is, that's where it is. Fighting with the rights, as Senator Evans described, the basic human rights of the majority of people in Asia, not with the authoritarian regimes and dictatorships that control them. And I think once that has been established on principle, the nations are not represented by their regimes necessarily, but are collections, conflicts, communities of people. Once that has been established, I think, Even that kind of thinking is radical thinking for that. When Australia doesn't have a long way from that. Trade would go on.
for Australia to be frightened that its economic relations with various regimes would collapse as a result of it taking,
as a result of simply supporting in substance the statements of principle
made by its
leading representatives.
It's just
it just wouldn't happen.
Yes,
I wasn't thinking about it. Oh, I did mention on the book that has been.
Did I have a
dream? No.
I
think everything you said is
absolutely correct.
Well, it's terribly difficult.
I quite would one political scientist today
and you there and written some absolutely wonderful papers.
Published by the media,
it's almost impossible.
Because it's small out and because the press
is so tightly
owned, it's a little diversity. And your favourite academics have been recycled time and again. I'm not going to mention them, but I know them as spheres of power. But I'm interested in Asia and Australia, and I can. Whereas, there's no debate. I mean, the word debate is forceful. There's no debate at all. It's only a recycle.
Through and through.
So, which would come first? I'm not sure. I was in the press first, and then the academic rival.
I would
think the problem of media in Australia is the best problem. And there are too many other books
the
media speaks with one voice. And we occasionally
we see those other exceptions break out.
For instance, the sort of realization that
the commission
inquiry into
ASIS.
Whilst that's not going to produce any real reforms within ASIS, but we're going to produce new draconian laws against the world,
new secrets
and strength,
and
terribly, the sort of draconian laws that even ASIS.
Well, we do have them
here.
The
guideline,
the new guideline,
showing some pretense
for both
Mr. Perrin
with what has now been proposed by Senator Evans with the Australian Secret
Intelligence
Service.
Such as Bartoli and others have followed his lead. There's an excellent critical analysis of
Bessel. What do you mean?
For freedom of expression, freedom of speech, generally. But, you know,
there's a friend of mine
once said, yeah, I'm for real.
I don't care about that.
Why not? Oh, yeah, come
here. Black or...
I'm just coming, I'm quite wrong. I wasn't on the right path. I was on the level between past the whole and